Welcome to this panel on investigative journalism. My name is Steve Roberts. I'm a professor at George Washington University and actually teach a course in journalistic ethics, which I hasten to add is not a contradiction in terms, although many people think it is. I also spent 25 years as a reporter at the New York Times, although not as an investigative reporter, but worked with a lot of good ones. And we have a terrific panel tonight to talk about a subject that obviously is of enormous importance, and we're grateful that you all came out to participate in this, because we're going to make a few opening statements, but leave it open. I know all of you, by definition, are consumers of news, so all of you are directly or indirectly related to this topic. This is not like that lecture we had this afternoon on string theory, which I got to admit, he's a great guy. I fell sound asleep. I hope this subject is one that will be more directly related to your daily lives and your interests. Although I thought Brian did a wonderful job in that, passed me by. There are so many obvious ways in which the subject of investigative journalism is right on everybody's radar screen. Let me just run through one or two quick ones. One, of course, is a question that Ben and others are very familiar with, which is the enormous question of sourcing. How does investigative journalism continue? How do we adapt and in terms of how we use sources, how we identify sources, how we then correct mistakes from sources? A whole series of questions. There are enormous questions raised by the wave of attempts by federal and local prosecutors to summon investigative journalists to be witnesses in cases, an enormously troubling and interesting and important trend that we're seeing in half a dozen different venues around the country. The whole question of finances. How are news organizations going to be able to afford, in an era of fragmentation, going to be able to afford the enormously expensive business of devoting months to investigations which might not produce a word in the newspaper or a minute on the air? How do you do that in an age where news organizations are increasingly strapped for resources and under financial pressures? The question of politicians. In the last few weeks, we've seen the President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, the Vice President, all explicitly and with considerable venom attack the New York Times and other news organizations for publishing investigative reports. Obviously, that is an issue of enormous interest. So I think of a quote from Bill Keller, now the executive editor of the New York Times, who said, "I'm not sure journalists understand what a threat we're under." So that's my starting off point for asking my colleagues here on the panel to give their thoughts, 5, 7 minutes, however long they want to talk, opening statements, what's on their minds, because I know each of them has a particular take and interest on this, and then we'll just open it to you, and you can ask what's ever on your mind, because as I say, I know this is a subject you all have strong feelings about, and I want to give you a chance to voice your opinion. So you've all read their biographies. I'm not going to go into this at great length, but I will just identify the three. Down at the end, Ben Bradley, better known as Jason Robards. After you get Jason Robards to play in the movies, I mean, it's not quite as good as having Robert Redford play in the movies, but
better.
It's pretty damn good.
Better.
who in many ways was the man who fostered one of the great eras of investigative journalism that every one of us as journalists in that era, even if, as with me, found myself working for the New York Times, getting my rear end whipped day after night in those period, still remember with great pride and fondness the standards that Ben's Washington Post set then and continues to set, as Dana Priest's Pulitzer Prize this year certainly exemplifies. James Bennett, some of you were expecting Walter Isaacson on this panel. Walter, because he has so many duties as running the Aspen Institute, couldn't come, but
But feel Jim, free to get up and leave.
Jim, a long and distinguished career at the New York Times for about 15 years, and just recently, 3 months ago, took over as the new editor of The Atlantic, which has moved to Washington. And as Jim was telling me, in part because they want to be closer to the news, closer as, and be more a part of this process of investigative journalism. So Jim provides the perspective of magazine journalism, as does Priscilla Payton, who is the executive editor of Time Magazine, which also in this era has produced a whole series of very significant investigative pieces. So with apologies for being representatives of the old media, we don't have a single blogger on the panel, but I want to give each of my friends and colleagues a few minutes to talk about what they think is important on investigative journalism. As I say, then we'll open it up to you. So, Ben, why don't you start?
Well, let's define it, investigative journalism, just a little, okay? Because it isn't really different from journalism. If you ask three questions instead of two, are you an investigative reporter all of a sudden? I think you are. Investigative means to zero in on a subject and keep at it, but it's still the same kind of reporting. Journalism is so exciting. It's such an interesting profession. You don't have any questions. I mean, you look for answers, anything you want, anything that bothers you, anything that interests you. If you have an owner first, that's the beginning of a good investigative journal, is the owner. You've got to have an owner who wants to do that, who's not scared of going to, in my case, the ladies friendly, and was for years, Catherine Graham, and have her friend say, well, what are you doing? Poking around so-and-so. So once you have a good owner, you have an editor who I had at the Washington Post, who was just never went to college, just was the most curious man, the most literate man, the best educated man I ever met, but who loved to dig, just loved to dig, whether it was a chief of police who had cops painting his house outside of, I cut my teeth on that story. And they played the hell out of it. And I just loved it. And the idea of, as I grew older, the he said, she said journalism didn't interest me so much. And Washington is so structured that somebody introduces a bill in the House. You have a story about the bill being introduced. Then you have a story about a committee hearing in the House. And then you have a story about a vote in the House. Nothing has happened, really. Then you move over to the Senate. Same thing, same thing, same thing, three times. Finally, they get together and they, how many threes is that? But the eighth time, it says the bill is, it's a law or it isn't a law. That doesn't interest me as much as it used to. When I first went there, I thought it was marvelous. Anything had to do with the Hill was marvelous. But now I think that it's the story that you could just take yourself and go off on one corner. I hate to think that, but it's true, that when I die, it's going to be, Watergate's going to be in the goddamn lead, isn't it? For years, I thought it was going to be Janet
Cook.
Benjamin C. Brandy. His career was marred by an incident this way. At least the second paragraph. I think I couldn't even remember her name.
It's after the jump now.
God, we're making progress. let's just talk about it. It's such fun to do and. I love to watch the journalists get such a kick out of it too.
Jim, what are some of your thoughts?
I'd actually prepared a talk on string theory, so I'm going to have to recalibrate a little bit. I had come with a narrower definition of investigative journalism in mind, having not been one myself and worked with investigative journalists over the years on various projects, and always thought of them as kind of the sorcerers of the business, the guys who would disappear for 6 months, do deep dives into documentation, cultivating sources, and some level of prestidigitation, and would emerge with an enormous project that would run in the paper. The characteristics were of this. Again, it took an enormous investment from the newspaper to do this. The paper was willing to make a huge commitment, give somebody the time, the resources they need to go dig into a story that they thought might have a payoff, but might well not. I mean, it was possible that after 3 months or 4 months, they'd come back. I'm sure you must have had this experience, and they just didn't have very much, and nothing would come out of it. And one of the great things about American journalism over the last 40 or 50 years, really even beginning with Lincoln Steffens, who we were talking about, was this great tradition of real muckraking. And what I worry about is, while there still are strong owners of the major American newspapers, Wall Street is increasingly an owner of these papers. The stocks are traded every day. What I think is a crazy standard for profitability has been set in the newspaper industry. It was set by Gannett 15 years ago now, 20% net margins. So the expectation...
That's about 23 or 24 in many places.
Yeah. I mean, the expectation is that these newspapers are supposed to be cash cows. Now, there's the issue of political pressure, which is tremendous right now, and that, I think that quote from Bill Keller reflects that. I'm hoping that that's a short-term problem. The longer-term structural problem is, how do you continue to make these profit targets while investing as heavily in the kind of journalism in which we believe? And the web is changing all of that. I mean, we quite properly don't have a web journalist up here, I think, tonight, because they don't do anything that remotely approximates investigative journalism. A lot of them do very interesting stuff, but they require the newspapers and the magazines to be doing the real reporting, which they then can riff off of. I mean, it's fundamentally a parasitical kind of role. Already you're seeing metropolitan dailies particularly. I don't know how big city government is covered in most cities across the country now. They've cut back so heavily as the classified advertising has moved to the web. They already aren't investing in these sorts of projects. I know that the New York Times still is. They still view it as part of the core mission of the newspaper. But my big fear is, over the next 4 or 5 years, over a fairly short period of time, how they are going to establish a new model to pay for the kind of news gathering that they now do. I think they're going to figure it out. I'm an optimist about this, but this is what does keep me up at night.
Okay, Priscilla.
Well, I'm a stock owner in Time Warner, if you've ever heard of the stock and what happened to it. But also the proud... member of a team that produced the Haditha story recently. And I, like Ben, don't quite know if that's technically investigative journalism. All I know is that somebody asked the third question. I had to think about this, so I made some notes, because I don't really think about investigative journalism on a daily basis. I just, like Ben, hope that we have a Baghdad bureau long enough to forge the sources that produce that story. But I have very mixed feelings about the status of journalism today. On the bad side of the ledger are very important, slightly technical issues that have gone against us and that are important to remember. One is what's happened to what they call Freedom of Information Act requests since the Bush administration has taken over. Before 9/11, they were already preparing a memo to change the rule on that. In the past, you had to prove what reasons not to produce the document that a journalist wanted. Now you have to produce. Now the rule change in October 2001 after 9/11 is you simply have to produce the reason for being able to withhold it, and that's had a chilling effect. So has a Supreme Court decision that makes people who lose in those fights end up paying the legal bills. And you end up seeing investigative organizations like ours having to think about what those costs entail. Even if you disagree with the New York Times about whether they should or should not have published the SWIFT transaction investigation or eavesdropping, you have to look at the whole landscape and see that not since the Nixon administration has there been such an increase in subpoenas to reporters to obtain something about their confidential sources or something related to their confidential reporting. So that is very disturbing. And Gonzalez had said he would look at all laws that might apply in the eavesdropping case, which would mean that people like Jim Risen and Eric Lipow would be subject to violations.
The two reporters from the New York Times who wrote
who
the
broke the eavesdropping story, thanks, Steve, that they would be potentially exposed to violation of the Espionage Act. On the other hand, in terms of the good news, I agreed completely with James when he says that if you're thinking very self-interestedly from a branding point of view, investigative reporting is going to be affiliated with the great brands of journalism, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, Time Magazine, and all of the other publications out there. It's where the Internet is left in the dust. The Internet, by the way, has produced its own army of self-appointed investigators, and it has given us stories like, you know, the Bill O'Reilly sex harassment case or Mr. Fry's non-fiction, actual fiction novel. So it's been very useful in that sense. And the biggest change, I think, in investigative reporting since the Watergate era has been what's been possible to do with the Internet and with programs like Excel in terms of transposing large pieces of data on other pieces of data and being able to produce a social picture that we weren't able to do efficiently 20 or 30 years ago. So I'm optimistic about that. The other thing I'm optimistic about is that there will always be a group of disaffected people in a government who will always want to look for a reporter who will listen to that disaffected person and tell us what's really going on. And you've seen this in, even in the Bush administration, starting with the book from the former
Secretary of Treasury,
all the way to Ron Suskind's second book on what really went wrong after 9/11. They can try to stop the leaks, but the alienation goes on, and we profit from that.
But there's a rhythm to it. I mean, an administration comes in, and then you could put money down on when is the first investigation of a leak. I mean, and then they'll all get together and they'll pull the chin and all that.
Well, you've been around long enough to know that this is not a partisan issue, that is as hostile as this administration is to the press today. No one hated the press more during the Clinton administration than President Clinton, with the possible exception of Hillary Clinton.
Don't forget Lyndon Johnson, who had very good credentials in this area.
Let me ask all of you. All of you are news executives in one form or another, or have been. Let me ask just one question of my own. One issue that's come up repeatedly in the last few months is this issue of how do you balance national security concerns versus the public's right to know. This came up in the New York Times eavesdropping case, where they held the story for a whole year. For people who think that all we do is print whatever we get without giving a damn,
that's ridiculous.
The story was held for a whole year. The Washington Post, after considerable discussions, withheld the names of the specific countries where the prisons were located, secret prisons were located. I want each of you to give our listeners a sense of how, as executives and writers, you balance these conflicting these two profound values: the public's right to know and the public's right to be safe.
Well, I'll tell you what drives me batty is that you get some guy comes to Washington. He used to have a large Oldsmobile agency in some town in Kansas. okay? And suddenly he's an assistant secretary of defense. And he's got a clearance that goes all the way out to Q and back. And his favorite phrase 20 minutes after he gets to town is national security. National security. I don't think I could do it, but I would really like to bet somebody that I have never seen an example, I've never been presented as an editor, and I've really been active in this field, of something that I really thought was a violation of national security. Really thought. I've read the entire Pentagon Papers, not the entire, but the 40 volumes of those, but I read most of the Pentagon Papers. And there was nothing in there. There was really nothing. We found in there the names of two CIA agents in Saigon. So we said, boy, we're looking for brownie points. We said, well, we'll kick their names out. And sucking up to Richard Helms sometime later, I told him this story. And he said, that was very nice of you. Those guys were out of Saigon the minute we knew there was going to be something called the Pentagon Papers.
But your own paper won a Pulitzer Prize for a story this year where, as a result of discussions and conversations and requests from the Pentagon, you did withhold key information about the location of the secret prisons. You did it as an institution for a reason. Give our listeners a sense of how you balance it.
Well, since I'm not part of it now, I've been out of there for quite a while. But I know what they...
Did you agree with the decision?
What?
Did you agree with the decision?
Well, I don't know enough about it. Probably, it didn't seem to me... It didn't hurt the story a hell of a lot. I think you... I'm trying to tell you that newspaper people are patriots too. They really are. They care about their country. Those of us a little bit older than the rest of us served in various parts of the service. They had where they had quite high clearances, rather higher than the guy that sold pizzas in Kansas or whatever he sold.
Oldsmobiles,
yeah.
They don't even make Oldsmobiles anymore, Ben.
What?
They don't even make Oldsmobiles anymore.
Picky.
What do you two think, Jim?
Well, I completely agree with that. This is treated as though the news organizations are tremendously frivolous in publishing these stories, when in fact they agonize over it.
They really do.
And weigh their responsibilities. Now, it's again easy to caricature because they are unelected, and that's the line you always hear. Who appointed these guys? They are, to a degree, self-appointed guardians of the public interest. It's a very unusual role they have, but it's one that is safeguarded by the Constitution. It's one of the things that makes this country such a great place. And they are very patriotic. Most of us believe that sunlight is ultimately the best disinfectant and getting this stuff out there is very important for the public. But there was a really interesting op-ed that was published last weekend by the editors of the New York Times and the LA Times. The Washington Post declined to participate.
I don't know why they did that.
Because they declined always. They never do this sort of thing.
And the Journal, too.
Snobby.
Yeah. By Bill Keller and Dean Baquet, and if you read all the way through it, towards the end they fainted at several stories they've got that they haven't published over the last couple of years. I mean, things that they came to believe in detailed, lengthy conversations with the administration would, in fact, endanger the national interest. So one cannot emphasize enough how seriously they take these things. And, of course, you should probably talk about the Bay of Pigs experience in the New
not
York Times.
Not quite that old.
No, no, but I know. But Scotty, Scotty was very involved.
And that's
in
true. It's true. It's one of the things that the President Kennedy himself said many times, as Ben knows far better than any of us, that he kind of wished the New York Times had published the Bay of Pigs.
The Times had the story beforehand. Kennedy prevailed on the bureau chief at the time. Washington bureau chief not to publish it.
And the publisher, yeah.
And the publisher, of course, yeah.
Yeah, true. Priscilla, what's your take on this? If you, as executive editor of Time, if you dealt with these questions where you had to make a decision, try to take seriously requests from security and defense agencies, and how do you balance these?
I think Ben and James sort of said it very well, which is that it really is a matter of being in the room and listening to the information on the other side, but that the history of journalism and journalism in wartime is a history of a huge tug of war, and that for the most part, and I know that Katharine Graham, for instance, had a qualm about a story that got published ahead of the Marines being hurt in Lebanon. For the most part, that tug of war has ended up with the public being served and the government not being harmed. And I think Ben is absolutely right that journalists are patriots, and by the way, you know, that can sometimes end up being to the detriment of the public, because when people ask us, why didn't you get the WMD story right, we have to say to them, well, you know, we were as scared as you were of the next attack, and we're human beings too, and maybe we should have been emotionless and much more anti-establishmentarian at the time, but we weren't. And that, I think, reflects the fact that we are organically the product of the community that we belong to.
Interesting point, Ben.
Let me tell you a story that formed my, or began to form my feeling about national security. I was the lowest of the lower reporters. I can't remember whether it was at Newsweek or the Post. I ended up in the office of a man called Otto Passman, who was a congressman from Louisiana, without any distinction at all, but I had an assignment on the question of foreign aid, about which I didn't know a great deal. He was on the foreign aid committee. And I wanted to, he wanted to screw somebody in the whole foreign aid administration. So he picked out a document from his desk, and he took a pair of scissors, and he cut off the classification of this thing on top. He just snipped it off this way, put it on the top of his desk, and ripped it out like that and gave it to me. And it was some, it was interesting, but it wasn't anything secret as far as I could see. It was something that I don't even remember all that well, but it had to do with somebody trying to, in their testimony on foreign aid, to try to ignore something. And but I still, every time somebody says top secret to me, I see this guy snip. and it's, it, I mean, you can imagine that. You can, any one of you can imagine that.
And the flip side of that is what Pat Moynihan always used to say, that the, you know, the people would get down to the Senate stationery store and buy stamps that said top secret, you know, and just stamp every document in the office that came through. I want to give folks in the audience a chance to ask some questions, as I promised. So do we have microphones, or can people just talk? There are mics on the, there's a mic on the side, so why don't you stand up, go to the mics. We're happy to have you join in. Ask whatever you want, and we'll try to get you some answers here.
The question I have is, we have continually said in the newspaper, when we are at war. Now, as far as I know, there's never been a formal declaration of war, as there were in other wars. The Korean conflict was called a war, and it certainly looked a lot more like the wars we'd fought before, so it had some recognition. This current situation in Iraq, we're at war in Iraq, I'm not sure who with, because there's an undefined enemy if we are at war. There is the war on terror, which is worldwide, and as far as I can tell, open-ended for decades or whatever. Will there come a time in which the newspapers or the press will somehow stop referring to this as war? We are at war. Because in a sense, it doesn't look anything familiar to me like a war. It's a conflict, it's incidents, it's whatever it is. But the use of the term ends up becoming a rationale for people saying, oh, you can't do that because we're at war, or you're a traitor because we're at war, or the president should be able to do this because we're at war. The constant referral to it in the paper seems to reinforce that and leave no room for the kind of discussion I think that ought to go on.
Well, sure, it's a war. 2,600 people dead? I mean, I don't know if we have to define war by the number of GIs killed, but of course it's a war. Now, if you can put a small W on it if you want, but I don't know that I think that's a really important distinction. I mean, the country is at war.
I think our job is to...
Do you all disagree with that?
I don't, but I also think our job is to sort of air the debate on this very question, which we've done from day one, which is a debate the Europeans have had with us from day one, which is, this is a police action. That's their argument. But that's the debate we put in our pages within weeks of 9/11, and it's not stopped. It's not our job. We can clean up the rhetoric, but the ultimately readers are going to make their judgment about what they think it is and whether they want to reelect the people who use that rhetoric.
Was Korea a war?
Well, I think part of also what we are stuck with, when you have a president who repeats the word repeatedly, to some extent we do feel a necessity to give the president his due. But I think one of the things that has happened increasingly, and some of the investigative stories we're talking about have made this point, that even if it is a war, leaving aside if we agree with Ben that it is still a war, does that justify repression of civil liberties? Does it justify the containment at Guantanamo? And that's one of the reasons why the Supreme Court decision, I think, was so important in terms of the very point you're making. Because what the Supreme Court said in no uncertain terms was, even if this is war, there are limits on presidential power.
But we do have a constitution that defines the process of declaring war, which if we don't...
Well, that's a really beside the point. We haven't had a declared war in a long time.
The Constitution's not beside the point.
No, well... In journalistically, we're talking about, I don't want to get a legalistic argument with you. This is a journalistic question of how we respond to official arguments that because there is a war, whether it's declared or not, therefore certain things are not permissible. What I'm saying to you is I think that a lot of the investigative stories have made the point, and the Supreme Court has made the point, that even if there is a war, even if the President and the Secretary of Defense continue to use the word, that does not give them unfettered license to pursue the incarcerations and the prisons and the eavesdropping and all the other things we've talked about.
I do think, just to jump in, I think it's a pretty profound question and not just a journalistic question. In fact, it's less a journalistic question than it is the debate that Priscilla referred to that's been going on since the very beginning about if this is a war, setting aside the legalistic questions, how do we actually define victory? What is the end point of this war? When will it ever end? This is not by any means to minimize how important this struggle is and how difficult this struggle is, but is the country on a real war footing now? Are we fighting a war? Is this administration in perpetuity or as long as it lasts and perhaps its successor too going to behave with the kind of sense of executive freedom that it's asserted because we're at a state of war? Is that just an open-ended situation? I think this is a debate that has been going on for a while but hasn't yet crystallized to the degree I think it should. And it's a bigger question than the journalistic one.
And when you bring it back to something I mentioned earlier about the attempts by the administration in recent weeks to, I think the only word to use is intimidate the mainstream press by attacking the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the LA Times for their stories on the banking side of it. This is a very calculated attempt to use the idea of war as a way of bludgeoning newspapers into being more, to being less challenging and and more willing to go along with the administration's line. So that is a tension that's there very much.
You have Karl Rove coming down tomorrow, isn't he?
Yeah, ask him that.
Ask him. But
go ahead. Thanks for taking your call.
Yeah, this is on. Thanks for taking my question. And I'm Jason Lee. I live in Washington, D.C., and have worked on healthcare policy for the last 15 years. I understand there's a lot of interest, obviously, on national security in this discussion, but I believe the topic is investigative journalism. And clearly, the area of healthcare in this country is a huge one. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask the esteemed panel what they feel their responsibilities are in encouraging investigative journalism to not sell products so much as inform the American public about some of the basic issues surrounding Medicare, Medicaid, what's happening in the private insurance, employer-sponsored insurance, the uninsured, exposing some basic facts that will influence the health of the economy in the future. And as a secondary question, to what degree do investigative journalists work with those who study these issues in other settings to collaborate, to tell the stories that they're really unable to tell because they're trained as academicians, let's say, but they have important stories to tell, and the opportunities for partnering are just ripe for the picking. Thank you.
Thanks for the question. Anybody got a thought about that?
Well, speaking just for time, we have taken ads from pharmaceutical industries, but we've also written investigative stories that we've put on the cover about the degree to which those companies have or have not sort of made it easier for people to have access to affordable health care. It's a subject that even if you were not interested in it, your readers are hungry for it. I mean, when we put the subject on the cover, it's a sure seller on a regular basis, health of any kind. So from a purely marketing point of view, there's nothing that holds us back. In fact, everything is encouraging us to go ahead. And in terms of align ourselves with the people in the field, that's where we get the stories in the first place. That's the way it's always worked. And otherwise, we're in the wilderness without any kind of compass. Those are the people who give us our GPS system through those stories.
One of the things that's happened, I think, is we've all seen an increasing partnership between news organizations and independent investigative bodies. The area of campaign financing is a very good example, where there are institutions in Washington who have enormous databases and capabilities for doing what you were talking about, that is overlay data sets and finding patterns. A lot of the investigative work, for instance, that's been done about campaign contributions, a lot of that comes from independent NGOs and others. And I think in the area of healthcare, you're starting to see more of that. You look at, it's not really an investigative organization, but the Kaiser Foundation is a good example of one that presents a lot of data that can become the basis for investigative operations, and there are partnerships. I know National Public Radio, to take one example, has had a partnership with Kaiser in their in some of their polling operations. So it's a good point, because we have limited resources. And as the point I raised earlier, we're increasingly under financial pressures. If we can partner with organizations that are doing a lot of the basic data processing that undergirds a lot of this, it's very promising, and it expands our reach, I think, as investigators.
Your paper and my paper have an awful lot of resources. I mean, I wonder if you know how many reporters there are or newsroom employees on each of these papers. It's in the New York Times' case, I know it's over 1,000. 1,000. You know, that's a lot of fires, and it's a lot of cops, and it's a lot of accidents, and it's a lot of looking and digging.
But if we can use the expertise of people who make it their life work to look at certain databases, so much the better.
The guys working on something else, yeah.
Go ahead.
Hello, my name's Jim Oates. I would believe that over the past 50 years, since Watergate, the media, particularly the printed media, has enjoyed the public trust. Now, what happens, what concerns you when you see situations that happened at the New York Times or Dan Rather? To you folks, how do you protect against losing what I call the public trust when you have those kinds of events happen?
The same way business does. When the head of Enron goes to the slam, when the head of, businesses had more, nobody should have the trouble businesses had. But they're not as open.
But you enjoy the public trust greater than the business does, the business community.
Does the press, is the press more highly regarded than business?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Oh, yes.
You think they are?
Yes.
Well, I've remember those popularity polls? Did you ever see any of those?
We were under lawyers.
Yeah.
I mean, that right, James? Yeah. Or
over congressmen, but under lawyers.
I'm not sure where Oldsmobile deals were.
No. Below used car salesmen.
And Oldsmobile salesmen.
Other answers to this gentleman's question?
How do we recover from that?
Does it impact you, and how do you protect against it happening?
Oh, it certainly impacts you. You know, as I was a Times reporter during the whole Jason Blair scandal, you remember the serial fabricator, Fabulist, who wrote a lot of pieces in the Times before he was caught. And I was in Jerusalem for the New York Times at the time, and mercifully very far away, I thought, from this whole scandal, and was going to the Gaza Strip one day. To cover a story, and I was crossing the Erez checkpoint, which is the main crossing point into northern Gaza, very heavily fortified military post. And the Israeli soldier, you have to present it's gotten increasingly over the last few years, you have to go through a more and more involved process to get over what has become functionally an international boundary now. And the soldier, so I had to produce my passport and produce my press ID, and the soldier looked down and he said, "Oh, New York Times." He looked up and said, "Jace, do you know Jason Blair?" it affected us. And I got, in those days, I mean, long before that, it's one of the jobs where you get a tremendous amount of hate mail, really awful stuff from both sides. And trying to preserve your credibility in that job is very difficult because you're fly-specked constantly for any evidence of bias, any evidence that you're shading one way, and if you make a mistake, they'll kill you for it. So Jason Blair was a big problem for me because the email became, this is proof that you're just making stuff up all the time. We can't believe a word that you're writing in the paper. And since that's your stock in trade as a reporter, that hurts. But I do believe in the end, and I think the Times is in the process of proving this, a great executive editor of the New York Times, Joe Lelyveld, once said to me, the cure for this stuff is journalism.
Yeah. That's right.
And I really believe that.
Journalism and one other thing. I mean, I think one of the changes for the better has been the mechanisms good news organizations have created to become more open to the criticism and more reflective of our critics and more willing to admit our mistakes. I mean, it wasn't until Jason Blair that the New York Times created a public editor who has a column on, as you all know, in the New York Times. I remember a column a couple months ago, there was this controversy about Geraldo Rivera, nobody's idea of an ethical journalist, but he was criticized by Alessandra Stanley, a New York Times TV critic, where she said during Katrina that he had elbowed his way into a shot and pushed aside an emergency worker so he could be on television. And he protested, and he said, this isn't true. I didn't do that. Now, the public editor of the New York Times went and Bill Keller supported Alessandra Stanley, said, well, Geraldo, I mean, if he didn't do it, he could have done it, which I didn't think was exactly a highly ethical thing for Bill to say. And this public editor went and watched the tape frame by frame and did an article saying not only was the television critic of my newspaper wrong, the executive editor of my newspaper was wrong to defend her. Now, that happened after Jason Blair. And I think that's one of the answers to your question, that if we can prove to our audience that when we do make a mistake, we will correct it, we will expose it. When the New York Times spent many, many pages going back and correcting every mistake Jason Blair made that they could find, that's part of how you try to establish or at least regain some of this trust. Because we are going to make mistakes. It's a human business, very human business. We work on deadlines, and we're going to make mistakes. Part of the key question is, how do you handle mistakes? And I think we're getting much better at that. And I think, look at the Washington Post, the ombudsman column right next to the editorial page on Sunday, very prominent place, where an ombudsman every week is a reflection of the criticisms of her own paper.
And not just from Geraldo.
I actually am starting to worry we're getting too good at it. I don't know what you think, Ben. I'd be curious to hear.
I don't know. I mean, sometimes
I miss the old arrogant New York Times.
I don't. Go ahead.
Yes, I would like to ask the panel to expand a little bit on that question. And my question is one of accountability. We've seen what happened to the CEOs of corporations in America that do not perform correctly. They end up in jail, and that's a good thing, because if they screw up, they should be punished. Now, my question to you is, when you make a mistake, like USA Today with the story about the telephone companies, what is the accountability and what is the penalty?
Well, on the USA Today story, the first story they got wrong, which...
general issue, I use that as an example. Address the issue of accountability.
And you picked a paper that has an interesting record on that. They had a report of their own Jason Blair, who went abroad and made up stories about...
He was worse.
Yeah, okay. For Jason's sakes, I'll say he was worse. Riley was his last name?
Kelly.
Jack Kelly.
Anyway, he was fired. In the last installment, they got half the story wrong. They got a part of the story wrong. But the general gist of what they published turned out to be true. Every case... Well, it was a she, by the way, in the second story. And no, she didn't screw up. She got the story right. She got a few important details. Well, no, that's been reported, that she got the main story right, and then there were some corrections that had to be made about what exactly the phone companies did or did not agree to do in cooperation with the government. But in general, you will see that the purging mechanism of reporters who were consistently dishonest takes care of the bad apples, just as they're taken care of in other industries.
I mean, look, let me give you some names. Dan Rather, Howell Raines, Gerald Boyd. These are people who paid enormous penalties, as they should,
Judy
by the
Miller.
Way. Judy Miller. I mean...
A reporter who was put in jail.
Please go ahead.
I'm just going to say I don't think we should ever raise the notion of putting a reporter in jail lightly. And I don't think we...
CEOs violated criminal law. They went to jail. Well, you're shrugging yourself. Making a mistake in a newspaper is not the same as systematically looting a company and depriving thousands of workers of their pensions. If a newspaper reporter does violate the criminal law, I don't think any of us would have a problem in saying that the law should be upheld. But you asked, what is accountability? What Priscilla was saying is there are mechanisms of accountability. There are mechanisms. Look what Dan Rather. Dan Rather has left in humiliation. He paid an enormous price, which in my view was appropriate because I think he made an enormous mistake. But the implication of your question that we're unaccountable and don't pay for our mistakes, I think is just wrong. And I think the record repeatedly shows, as it should, I think they should pay the price. I agree with the premise, but I don't agree that they don't pay it. I think they do. You have a point.
I would say that. And you can't, you want to throw, what did you want to throw the guy in jail for? What?
He went up.
What did you want to throw him in jail for?
It's that gentleman right there.
No, he's retreated to the second row.
He's hiding on you, Ben. He's confusing you.
I didn't say should. I said why not?
Because he didn't violate a law. I mean, do you want to write a law that would throw this guy in jail?
To make a mistake is not to violate a law, necessarily.
Well, part of the reason why we have a First Amendment is that the First Amendment does protect the rights of people to make mistakes. You don't want a system where you have, say, an Official Secrets Act or other where the law is so tight that people don't have room to try and fail and make mistakes. But we've agreed there should be a very strong mechanism of accountability. But what Jim was, when Priscilla was raising about, to say the use of the espionage statute, you talk about possible violation of criminal law, is a very dangerous, extremely dangerous possibility that this law, a 1917 law which has been used once in 89 years, could be trotted out to try to criminalize the reporting of investigative reporters. Then you have an enormously dangerous precedent in my you and I think you would agree. So when you start talking about criminalizing this kind of behavior, even when you make mistakes, you've got to understand the price you pay for that. You get the next question.
Thank you. I have a practical question about the business of politics, and I'll tell you why I'm asking. I'm on the board of the Texas Observer, which is one of the few independent sources for investigative journalism in the country. And we're doing a lot of thinking about how do you get investigative journalism out there, how do you reach more people, and how do you do it with a business model that works, particularly in light of the Internet. Right now we have a really very rudimentary website, and we're still reaching twice as many people in 1 week on the web than we do 2 weeks with our print circulation. So what's the model? How do you charge for journalism? I know the New York Times recently changed how people can access their website, charging for some of it some, leaving the rest of it free. Do y'all have any suggestions for the Texas Observer?
That's a business question.
But a very important one. Very important one.
Yeah, the journalists on our board don't have answers either.
I don't do business.
You got some thoughts on this?
Look, this is a big question facing the whole industry right now, and nobody has figured this one out. In order to get anything from the Atlantic's website, not anything, but almost all the content is now behind a firewall, and you have to be a subscriber to the magazine. That helps bring more subscribers into the magazine, but the trade-off is that fewer people read our stuff. One of the paradoxes in the business right now is that papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post are being read by more people than ever by a factor of 10, thanks to the Internet. It's a wonderful thing. On the other hand, they're panicking because they can't on the business side, and actually on the other side because of stock ownership plans, which have done more to break down the Chinese wall than anything, I think. They're panicking because they can't figure out how to make it pay. And a lot of people think it was a great mistake in the first place to put the content up there for free, that from the very beginning that was a mistaken model. Others obviously argue that there's no stopping it.
Well, is the Wall Street Journal the only paper that charges for it?
Entirely, I think that's
yeah. Although everybody started in front of the wall, and everybody is now retreating behind the wall. And
next
the
great American fortune in the press will be made by somebody who could figure out how to make money out of the Internet.
But one of the reasons why your question is so important, as I said earlier, I think one of the key issues facing serious investigative journalism is how do we pay for it? Because we can all, as I do, glorify the vast number of choices people have now through technology and the web and cable television, whatever. But as the media universe fragments, the revenue stream that each news organization depends on narrows. And it's the kind of journalism we're talking about is very, very expensive to do. You have to be willing to assign people, some of your top highly paid people and editors, to work for months without any guarantee you're ever going to produce anything. You have to be able to be able to devote a lot of resources. So it's one of the key threats facing serious investigative journalism, as you say so well, is how do you get the resources to support it? And there's a big debate, and one of the debates, the phrases you hear is quality sells. Mm-hmm. That in the end, if you produce the kind of work that attracts attention and that people value as citizens, they will pay for it. And one of the models is actually National Public Radio, because there you have people willing to pay to support a news organization that produces quality information. So it's not as if it's all crap and it's all, you know, Lacey Peterson all the time. There are news organizations where people are willing to put their money and say, we're going to support it. So it's only a half of an answer, because the problem's very real. But there are people who are proving that quality can sell.
Well, and if it makes you feel better, I think we get more new subscribers through the web than we do in any other way, because they're attracted by stories.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
The question of the internet and bloggers, are traditional newspapers really necessary for investigative journalism? Do you see a day where a reporter maybe has his or her own brand, they go out and monetize on the web, potentially go directly to the public without going through an editor and a newspaper and traditional media? And if that does happen, what kind of restraint would there be in terms of national security or other forces that an editor might influence the journalist? What do you think is going to happen in the future when potentially mainstream media shifts more towards internet-type media?
Hmm. Very good question.
I think there's actually an old tradition of that, of a investigative journalist having his, unfortunately it was his for many years, brand. In Jack Anderson in Washington was famous for...
I.F. Stone.
And I.F. Stone for basically...
Lincoln Steffens, for that matter.
For having exactly their own operation. It's not reassuring that the FBI went to the Anderson family's apartment to secure his old files to be able to look into what they needed to look into even after he was dead. But there is a model that's actually quite historic for this, and I don't see why it couldn't happen. The good news is that there are now schools of journalism, especially the one run by Nick Lemon in New York at the Columbia School, which are actually teaching these skills and are opening next year a Center for Investigative Reporting, where... You know, presumably if you have learned how to read a spreadsheet or look at a CEO statement, you can start to get excited the way, you know, Ben and James and many journalists have about what's available out there and what you can find out without paying a dime, just by looking at what public documents give you. So I think that's a model that's historic and therefore has a chance of surviving long-term in the future.
But it's also true. I think they're not mutually exclusive, because I do think that mainstream journalistic enterprise are going to be necessary to do the kind of work that was celebrated in the Pulitzer Prizes this year. I don't see how Dana Priest, as good a journalist as she is, could have monetized her situation, to use your word, and been an independent, freelance, investigative reporter and produced the story that she did. You have to have the
institutions. She wants to eat.
You know, you have to have the institutional backing often, and it's not just the salary. It's the research help. It's all of the infrastructure that is very expensive that supports an investigative effort. At the same time, I do think you will see the recurrence of that old model, the independent muckraker, through the internet. People who can find ways, whether it's someone like Andrew Sullivan who gets contributions, or others like Coase who are making connections with other commercial enterprises that can monetize or subsidize their efforts. And the more the better. So I think that they're both good models. I think they both will flourish, but I don't think the internet will replace the other, because it can't. It just is not capable of mounting the resources, at least any near future, to do the kind of effort that we're talking about.
Well, Cy Hirsch tried to.
Well, that's even a good example.
On his own, Seymour Hirsch, first with the AP, sold it. One first story he sold, I guess, was
UPI. Yeah.
My Lai.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
But I remember him coming into the office of the Post, and he had this story. And
you told him you didn't want it?
Oh, yes, we did want it, but we didn't know who the hell Cy Hirsch was. And, I mean, he was talking about murders and torture and all this, and we said we needed a little more, you know, little corroboration. We asked our... No, I won't tell that story.
Oh, go ahead, man. Come on. You statute of limitations.
No, we asked our correspondent in Vietnam to check it out, and... he didn't. He knew Hirsch and didn't like Hirsch, and he didn't check it out properly. So we took a couple of extra days there.
We got time for a couple more. I'll get to. You do it quickly. We'll try to get to all three of you.
Sam Perry, to shift. I think that's very interesting. That subject is incredibly interesting on the independent operator. To shift back to the sources a little bit, Mr. Riley talked about this being a cyclical process. To what extent is the witch hunt process also cyclical, or how does that get rolled back? Because you mentioned, you know, Mr. Paul Neal and others who have names. It was said at a panel earlier tonight on civility in media that Barry Goldwater was helpful to the Post towards the end of Nixon's time and things like that. People of name can come across and be helpful in investigative reporting, but people who don't have a name, whether or not they're evading breaking a law, are certainly chilled under the current environment. How does that get changed, in other words? Yeah.
Go ahead.
I don't know. I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
What changes the, I mean, aside from a change in administration, what changes the environment? Is there anything historic that's changed the environment of witch hunting for, you know, well, Deep Throat was out for a long time, I suppose, but I mean, witch hunting for individuals who are sources in stories?
Well, one of the tough things to do, but most fun things to do in journalism, is to change your sources. Every 4 years, you know, one crowd goes out, and you're like Willie Loman. You shine your shoes and go out there again and make new friends with these fellas. And they want to talk, you know. God damn it. Let's not forget that. They love to talk. They really do. And you know, why should we line up and try to prevent them from talking?
Oh, I'm not suggesting that. I'm actually just suggesting that there are probably a lot of people who want to talk, but there's a very chilled environment right now when you're throwing journalists in jail to try to get them to reveal this.
I think you're talking about several factors. Yeah. One is, of course, it goes back to your earlier question of the rhetoric of war. I think you have an administration, even before 9/11 proved itself, as you pointed out about the FOIA strategies, highly secretive.
Exactly.
And distrustful of the press. And not only distrustful, but sort of viciously critical of it. And this is one of the points that Bill Keller made in a recent interview, that the comments are not just intimidating, they're truly nasty about the press, which shows very little appreciation for the role of an independent press. I think it's heightened by the nature of the administration and by the nature of the war. I think it tends to cool down when troops are not in harm's way.
I would say that 90% of the sources are not big names. That Paul O'Neill happens once in a while. Colin Powell happens once in a while. But that, you know, most of the sources for what we do are sort of the permanent bureaucracy. And you know, the CIA, thank God, had a bunch of folks who felt alienated in the post-September 11th period, and so you saw people who are not familiar names to most Americans, you know, tell their stories. But that tends to be the way it works, getting the big name is you know, frosting.
Two more. My name's Art Katz. I'm from Missouri, about 100 yards from Kansas, but I don't live in Kansas. Just to cover that. I'm interested in...
Are you an Oldsmobile dealer?
No, I'm not. I'm sorry. No. I'm interested in the segment of your audience that you feel is most interested in investigative journalism. I know it varies by the story, but I mean, who are some of the... I would think of them in marketing as a target for your investigative programs. Who are you aiming at particularly?
Well, in Washington, the audience is really the government. That's where the that's where most of the investigative stories begin and end. But if it's a good story, it's a good story. It doesn't make much difference whether it's.
Do you think it's men more than women, or younger more than older?
I wouldn't go there.
I'm just asking. I'm just saying. Do you have a face on the wall somewhere when such a story is being developed that you think about your reader, or your listener, or your viewer, or your typist?
Well, what's your question?
Who's the target for your audience? Who's the target for your story? Who are you writing the story for?
People who like good stories.
Yes. Yeah.
People who like good stories.
And what do you think the emotion is that they get out of reading your story? What is the?
Well,
what are they after?
It depends. Who are you talking about? I could think of a whole bunch of them there say, oh, they got that bastard this time, and I knew he was a crook. Or, my God, they're always after him. Why don't they leave him alone? You know, the reactions are as varied as possible.
Okay. But they're also, look, I think there's also, to be corny about it, there's an element of citizenship. I mean, I think we're educating voters. I think that's a target audience of any investigative report because it gives voters more ability to make judgments on the, you know, I think that is part of it, too. You get the last question.
Mine's sort of a question and a statement. My name is Fred Mawney, and I've been a paralegal investigator, and it's kind of close to being an investigative journalist. And in fact, I'm debating on how. I'm just not the writer like y'all are, but I've been the guy in the field. And what is this? As I've watched this thing come out with the New York Times, and I've watched for any other investigative journalist to come out with it, from just my background of just watching, is how could these people be supposedly sitting in a field, in a hut, and arranged for the airplane bombings, and their money pops up our financial system, and they don't have no clue what's going on about following money through foreign banks. You understand what I mean? How could they do all that, and we don't have nobody can connect the dots, but all of a sudden they're supposed to be such idiots that they don't know what's going on? You understand what I'm saying there? Came out about the blasting the New York Times about releasing this information, and I'm saying, well, where's the answer back? And the other part, though, as even through my part and stuff, and because as a paralegal investigator, I started our history and history of other countries and something, and it's just so appalling to me from watch it. And I've worked the underworld side and all sides. I was just for hire, and Mr. Bradley, I was tied in with Mr. Just listening to people in the legal community when Sam Irvin
let me try to get an answer to your first question.
Yeah.
I think what the gentleman is asking is one of the arguments the administration has been making is that by publishing this information, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, has revealed information that's damaging to national security and helps the terrorists because it tells them about some investigations. What you're saying is, how could they not know that this? And this becomes part of any calculation any editor makes about how damaging is the revelation really to national security. As you said, everybody claims it's dangerous, but part of the job is to make a hard-headed judgment about how damaging it really
and
is.
And to be knowledgeable in that area.
Well, I mean, it was a joke to sit there and say something like that from my work and things I know, you know, then to make that position. And the other thing is, though, that when I start seeing a journalist getting locked up, I mean, that's the first stage of a Nazism of a, we're all going, it's going to be our door the next time. Go back to the history of Nazism and stuff and how they first said, well, I didn't say nothing because it was this person. I didn't say nothing because it was that person. Who was the writer about that? I just remember certain things. I don't try to remember everything. Just And then, next thing you know, they come to my door and there's nobody around to help.
I can't understand.
And that's what the investigative journalists are.
Thank you very much. You got a final word?
Just on that point, I mean, the Times and others have now come out and pointed out that the Treasury Department, long before the Times published the story, was boasting about its effective program at tracking financial transactions internationally. A congressman who's now being probably the toughest on the New York Times held hearings on this subject long before the Times published the story. Now, it's a little bit tricky for the paper because they want to say, well, we didn't really report anything new here. I mean, you know, it's sort of not exactly a position they want to be in. But the fact is that I totally agree with you. I mean, these guys have long since stopped using the international banking system to move money around.
I want to thank you all for coming. Two quick final notes. any of us would be happy to take your phone calls anytime you have any information where you want to.
That is so true.
I can tell you that a good deal of what passes for investigative journalism in Washington is picking up the phone at the right time. But also there is a question that goes to your question, several of the others have asked, which is the question of accountability. One of the great virtues of the web today is that you can all be press critics. You can't necessarily all be investigative journalists. That's a little harder. But the interactivity of this new medium does mean we are subject to far more scrutiny. The investigations we do, as I mentioned Dan Rather, but to many other examples, we are held to a much higher standard of accuracy and thoroughness by you. And that makes us better. So I hope you'll continue to do that. And each of you can be a watchdog and an ombudsman. And you all, and Ben will give you his email address so that you can all email it. Thanks very much.